Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Everybody, I'm glad you could share your time with me today, and I promise you it will be definitely worth your time. I have Jerry Cantor with me today, and he's written an amazing book called The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress. I found it fantastically fascinating, and I think it's a topic that will be of interest to many of you. In addition to working well for physical ailments, homeopathy offers remedies for engaging with the subconscious mind to ameliorate the embedded existential causes of chronic illness called miasms. And I may have mispronounced that. I've gone back and forth into the pronunciation. I'm going to have to ask him how to do it right for me. Jerry presents a diagnostic insight, specific homeopathic remedies, and successful case studies about the profound connections between the emotions and their physical manifestations in illness. He further correlates the five classical miasms and their core existential quandaries with the five elements and phase theory of traditional Chinese medicine. He likens inborn fundamental emotions to tools, each one designed to solve a stress-related problem. Self-sabotaging imbalances occur when an emotional tool is excessively used. So he explains how identifying a default emotional response, such as anxiety or anger, along with its accompanying physical symptoms, can determine the core existential stress or hereditary pattern underlying a chronic condition. For each of the five classical miasms and their associated physical and emotional conditions, he presents homeopathic remedies that modify and the impact of specific existential quandaries and explain their indications through detailed examples from his practice, revealing that the subconscious mind is amenable to change. He shows how to accurately select remedies to diffuse the energetic charge of unresolved existential stress and thus quell the root causes of chronic illnesses. He is a faculty member of the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine and owner of Vital Force Health, a Boston area homeopathy and acupuncture practice. And hopefully, welcome Jerry, and hopefully I haven't murdered too many words here.
I know you did very well with them. Thank you, Barbara.
I've stared at miasms, gosh, I can't tell you how long now, over a week and a half, wondering which way to pronounce it, and I couldn't even Google a right pronunciation of it. So At least you knew what I was talking about.
You did very well.
Okay, so just for those people who have heard existential mentioned a number of times here, let's explain what existentialism is first.
Yeah, sure. These days, that it's a kind of an egghead term, right? But it's gotten a lot more popular because of climate change and COVID and the possibility of war. It's basically, you know, these days people think, oh, my God, we're going to die. This is an existential crisis. Oh, my God. But the word really means more than that. It has to do with the meaning of life and the meaning of the crazy circumstances that we might find ourselves in, especially you came out of World War II, kind of French philosophy. I would say that the French, who are a sensuous people, they like to argue, they like to like good food, they like culture, the love of culture, and a lot of discourse. When they got occupied by the Germans and the, you know, goose-stepping, rigid, that kind of ideology, the French could no longer be the French, and they wondered who they were. Nothing seems to make sense anymore. So philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre started using that word, and talking about what was authentic and what was not authentic. Life didn't seem to make sense. And that was that philosophy of looking at things existentially and being very doubtful about universal values like the existence of God and perspectives where things made sense, that kind of got to the wayside and was replaced by this feeling of let's try to make sense of what makes no sense. You know, what does it mean, for example, for 6 million people to have been murdered for no particular reason? What makes it, what's the sense of an atomic bomb looming over us, you know? So anyway, that's where existentialism comes from. And there's a branch of psychology called existential psychology, which is also about meaning. You know, when people are distressed or unhappy, as opposed to giving them a happy pill or an antidepressant, giving them the tools to investigate, help them to make sense of their life, what really matters. It involves acceptance of some of the bad things that can happen in life and again, trying to make sense of them. That's existentialism. It's a search for meaning, essentially. And what I write about is that the chronic diseases that I study, that I treat, when I understand them from the standpoint of a homeopathic remedy, I can explain the existential issue that gives it meaning, and what that person who's sick is investigating at the subconscious level. Does that make sense to you, Barbara?
Yeah, it does, because I think what you just explained, you know, it brings greater clarity into my understanding of what's going on. I mean, you have. You've described manifestations of a problem, and in trying to figure out what causes that problem, you know, you go back into the emotions and things like that, and it means there's an imbalance in many cases in some area of consciousness that is causing the manifestation. And with homeopathy, you're bringing in elixir, I'll call them elixirs for want of a better word, but treatment that can help to bring balance into the physical, which then allows the emotional to flow more easily. So yeah, now this makes a great deal more sense.
Using high potency remedies, it actually addresses the problem, which is at the apex of the pyramid, which is the mental and the emotional issue. The physical symptoms actually come from that. I mean, if you have a physical injury, strong physical injury, that will disturb your mind. That would be in the acute situation. But chronic illnesses, I think they have their origin in something psychological to begin with, a trauma early in life, a feeling of having been treated, for example, in a belittling fashion, being made fun of, or having experienced some completely incomprehensible loss or dislocation of parents divorcing, Everybody experiences these things a little bit differently, but that trauma, which you know presents a problem which simply cannot be resolved, has consequences. Stop me if I'm talking too much here. I mean, you know, the idea of a divorce for a child, for example, has a very simple heart. A child, when parents get divorced, they go to a therapist or they try to tell the child, hey, we'll still love you. Nothing's going to change. You know, you'll go see mom on weekends, dad on the other weekends. Everything's going to be fine, right? Now, the heart of the child has a very different idea about this. And it says, you know, the only reason that you came into existence was to have me. If you're separate now, my life has no meaning. I have absolutely no value at all. And that's a particular remedy that can help that. But in other words, that's at the level of the subconscious. You cannot explain that away to a child. And children who need the remedy that represents that problem have a whole host of problems later on in life. They will have disturbed digestion. They'll have terrible skin problems. They probably will have warts. They'll be prone to obsessive thinking. That's one particular remedy, you know. And they'll find that they have a hard time accessing their self-interest. They'll make poor decisions, and they'll be spent a lot of their life will be full of anguish.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Personally, I really believe that almost everything is a result of an imbalance on an emotional level in some aspect within us, and I was blown away by how you would explain a situation, then you would literally tell people what went into your cure, and you know, and that's where you caught me. It was like, oh my goodness, it was fascinating, and it sent me back to homeopathy with a whole new respect, because some of these cures that you know, I mean, you went back into even the different organs in the body and what they needed and what they didn't need, and how with your with the treatment that you were advising, you know, there were all sorts of, I mean, I recognized some of the stuff. I recognized Arnica for sure. And it was it made so much sense to me. A little scary knowing what went into some of them. I think I'd rather just have somebody say, take this, it'll help, rather than tell me what's in it in some of the cases. But it was amazing. It was just phenomenal how intricate these treatments were to use to help people bring themselves back into a better balance so that they could emotionally deal better with what was going on in their life. And it fascinated me is how did these recipes, I'll call them recipes for want of a better word, how did they come into existence? Because obviously some of them come from ancient Chinese. And so how were they developed? I mean, it's mind-boggling how they were put together.
Well, it's not that mysterious, Barbara. Actually, the earliest, and they're called remedies. They're medicines, but they're called remedies. So the earliest ones from the 19th century were the same drugs that conventional doctors were using, just much, much more dilute. Borax, arsenic, sulfur, potassium carbonate. I mean, all these were regular drugs before the era of the patent medicines came along. You know, after the Flexner Report in 1910, and when Rockefeller got involved in converting petrochemical industry byproducts into drugs that he could patent and then make money on. Before that, everybody used the same sort of things, except they used different potencies of them. By which I mean, so, you know, doctors use them at full strength. Conventional doctors, we called allopaths. And the homeopaths use the same ones, but very, very dilute. So they're often very much the same substance. But homeopaths then did branch off into making remedies from plants and from the venoms of animals and all kinds of things. We have thousands of remedies that were used. But you mentioned arnica, so maybe I could say something about that to demystify it, because there's nothing to be afraid of with these things. Yeah, it's true that the original substance that they're made from in many cases is awful, venom of a snake or something like that, or arsenic. But we get a paradoxical effect. This is the law of similars that's germane to homeopathy. It treats what it would otherwise cause, right? So arsenic is a deadly poison. And you get a presentiment of death if you're actually poisoned by arsenic. You think, okay, there's not much time left. I have no margin for error here. And your circulation contracts inside your body, and your extremities get cold, and you may feel a burning sensation inside. Yeah, that's a bad thing. But when you dilute it and convert it into a homeopathic remedy where there's none of the actual material of arsenic there, and it just has the emotional component, that's a major remedy for anxiety. It's a major remedy for anorexia nervosa. It's a major remedy for people who are terrible perfectionists, you know, or people who are obsessed with death. Now, arnica, which is, you know, a flower that grows high up in the mountains, people use that left and right for trauma, right? If you bruise yourself or if you fall down and have an accident. But I think it's liberating to know what the psychological part of arnica is, and it makes things have a lot more sense. So, ever have a situation where you have an injury or you see somebody who's had a significant injury and you come up to them and you say, are you okay? And they say, yeah, I'm okay, and they want to continue doing what they're doing. They're actually in a state of shock, right? They haven't absorbed what's happening. So I believe that there's a level of consciousness that we all have, and there's many levels of consciousness. This level of the consciousness, I don't know what its name would be, but it's invested in our being intact, in our being complete, right? Now, if you have a significant accident, and there's many degrees of that, but let's say something horrible like an amputation or a loss of blood or severe head trauma, this level of consciousness says, you know, the facts of the matter don't match my understanding here, so I'm out of here. I'm getting out of here. And this is a kind of a psychological explanation of the state of shock. Uh-huh. Now, in that state, you're not as reactive, and you're not in your body. Your whole body is not intact. And that's good maybe temporarily, because if you have a serious accident, you cannot absorb the full impact of what's happened to you there. Doesn't mean you're particularly brave. Doesn't mean that you have incredible wherewithal. It just means you're in shock. But you don't heal as well when this level of consciousness is in exile, has left your body. So what arnica does, it pulls the soul, this level of consciousness, back into the body. And now you're more intact, and now you can heal better. That's why arnica works. People think, you know, it just kills pain or something. That's not it at all. The homeopathic arnica actually does something much more interesting, that it pulls the soul back into the body. In Chinese culture, when babies have like a glazed look and they don't feel like they're right well there, the Chinese don't give them arnica, but they pull in their earlobes for exactly the same reason. It brings the soul back into the body. And that's really important for healing. Of course, when your soul is back in the body and you come out of shock, suddenly you're aware of everything. And now maybe you're screaming, you're crying, and you're able to actually engage with the trauma that you've had. But that's necessary.
Well, I know I use it. It's part of my, along with aloe, stuff that I have always on hand, because I've seen what it does for black and blue marks on your skin. I mean, they go away. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. They go away because this level of consciousness has returned to your body, and you're completely inhabited by spirit. And it's not anything. That's an amazing thing. But there's nothing material. There's none of the actual physical content of the herb in that remedy anymore. It's just the energy of it. Is that interesting?
That's fascinating. So, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, can this be applied or am I too far afield? If you're bringing some form of suffering or dysfunctionality into this lifetime from a past lifetime, can it also then treat that?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Well, now you're actually touching on the topic you mentioned earlier, which is the miasm, M-I-A-S-M.
Yeah.
So the miasms are something that's inherited, which means that someone of your ancestors who had a disease, you know, that they couldn't overcome, there's an impact of that that is left on you, let's say epigenetically. So we don't come into this earth blank slates. We carry stuff from other lifetimes that is that can be absolutely treated with homeopathy. We have to do it, in fact. Otherwise, we could not. We don't have any success treating chronic illness because no one is a blank slate when they come here. So yeah, there are miasmatic remedies that we use routinely to help people clear the trauma from earlier other lifetimes, let's say, or our ancestors. In families, you'll know there's always a legacy. This is, I don't know why this is even controversial. You know, a child will be born with an amazing musical ability, and lo and behold, their parents were musicians, you know, or literary families. Things get carried forward. And it goes not just one generation, but often many generations back. There are people who have that I'm sure you've interviewed who have these amazing abilities to see deep into legacies and tell you, you know, who your guides are, what angels are looking over you, who are inspiring you with their powers. But we have, you know, no one, just as the apple never falls far from the tree in a family, your parents also are carrying stuff from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. So things come through. Reincarnation. I don't know, but that's a definite possibility too. That's going on. But in any way, with homeopathy, we simply treat what's in front of us, try to figure out what it is, and we give the remedy that matches the situation.
Yeah, that was the other thing. How does one diagnose? I mean, certainly there will be behaviors that are there that you can look at, but how do you know the behavior is the manifestation of one of many things that it could be?
Yeah, that's the skill of a practitioner. We have great tools. We have we have these books we have called Repertory and the Materia Medica, and we know these substances inside out, how they manifest at the mental level, the physical level, spiritual level. So the symptoms that somebody has are actually, they're not separate from that. They are the way the body talks, the way the body expresses its problem. Earlier I mentioned people who had poor self-esteem used growing warts.
Uh-huh.
Some of this is simply old folk wisdom that our inner ugliness comes out in a wart. Well, that's true. The body is trying to project outward how the mind feels inwardly. You know, you've told me I'm ugly. You told me I'm stupid. Here, I'm going to deny it with my words and my behavior, but the body will betray it. I'm going to produce these horrible warts that come out. That's the body speaking. Anyway, this is the cool thing with homeopathy. The kind of things that upset doctors that find that they get distracted by, that they don't want to hear about, these specific weird little symptoms, those are absolute gold to a homeopath because we have them all referenced. They reference themselves to remedies that which as gross substances would produce those symptoms in people. So the trick of becoming a homeopath is identifying those symptoms, knowing how to research them, converting them into rubrics, which is a description of the symptom, referencing it back to the medicine. And then we hone in on exactly the medicine that fits you at the personality level, the character level, you know, and that covers the exact symptoms that you have. It's a cool thing to study and to practice.
Well, now, once you've done that, once you have diagnosed it, and you've treated it, and the manifestation has gone away, what happens on an emotional level? Do the emotions need to be treated therapeutically as well,
that automatically happens. That automatically happens, Barbara. That's exactly what happens. They're not separate. The mind and the body are completely one. You don't have to have a separate discipline for it. You know, in Chinese medicine, it's funny, in the West we still have a hard time getting used to that. Whoa, the mind and the body are connected. If you study Chinese medicine, for example, you go to the acupuncturist, you tell the acupuncturist that you've got loose stools, the acupuncturist will automatically know that you worry too much, automatically, that you're a brooder, that you worry too much, that you get obsessive. The other way around, too, if you're a brooder and you confess to thinking about things too much, the acupuncturist will automatically suspect that you have loose stools. It's completely hardwired. If you've had a big long-term grief, the acupuncturist will automatically know that there's something disharmonizing your lungs. Other way around too. If you see the acupuncturist or the herbalist and you say that you have asthma for a long time or you have history of bronchitis, will automatically suspect that you've had an unresolved grief. Now, in homeopathy, it's not just hardwired connection. It's one and the same thing. If I tell you that someone who's had an accident and suddenly they're not in their body, are those two things separate? The fact that they're in shock and they've had this accident, they're not separate. So both things happen at the same time. The soul is pulled into the body. In other words, you come out of shock, and then your healing starts and your bruises go away and your circulation improves. They are not separate. They're one and the same thing.
It's amazing, a lot of the cases that you talked about. And with traditional medicine, they give you something that makes the manifestation go away, but it doesn't address the other issue. So people, are routinely going back for the same ailment over and over and over again. And nobody thinks about, is there another level that should be treated here?
Well, that works great for the economy, doesn't it? Now you got to pay the psychologist and the internist and the surgeon. And homeopathy is one-stop shopping. We are not cars. We are not something you just fix. In a car, the carburetor and the exhaust system are completely separate. You can fix your exhaust system. It'll have no impact on your carburetor and vice versa. But in human beings, in living things, everything is connected. And homeopathy walks that talk. We've been doing this for a couple of centuries now, and this is nothing new to us. This is what we do every single day. If you have your case taken by a homeopath, you'll be asked what sort of situations upset you, how you get when you're upset, what the history of that has been. Everything will be asked, what kind of symptoms how you typically get sick. All these things will be asked. And then the homeopath, after asking a bunch of weird questions, and because he or she has to differentiate between various remedies, will come up with a remedy. And it's not a diagnosis exactly. The homeopathy is not driven by medical diagnosis. It's driven by the remedy, what I call the remedy state. If I say you're in an arnica state, that's my diagnosis. That means you need arnica right away. If I say you're in a thuja state, that means your self-esteem is horrendous and you have a very inauthentic sense of yourself, and that's why it may feel like your intestines are moving around, why you crave chocolate, why you have these terrible skin conditions, why your scalp is dry, why you can't access your self-interest, all kinds of things like that. They're all of the same cloth. And then the remedy, once it's given, which is that substance, thuja is a plant, is a remedy made from a plant called arbor vitae. And so that plant diluted becomes the remedy. And all these things, they change, maybe not exactly at the same second, but absolutely the case, after you give that remedy, someone who's been living in anguish shifts. And that feeling of being inauthentic, like living in the wrong, they can't stand to be in their own skin, that transforms, and it brings forward a more authentic trauma that was buried by, that was sort of, you were insulated from by that remedy state. Maybe the sadness, the sadness of having been treated badly as a child.
Are there illnesses that cannot be treated with homeopathy?
None that I know of. But again, we don't care about the name of the illness. Any five people with the same diagnosis of an illness will get different remedies. The diagnostic terms in conventional medicine are to some extent, they're misleading, and because there's so many different kinds of people who have that same diagnosis. In any case, we have to go through this process to find out what's at the root of it. We want to find out what the root cause of, of those symptoms is. But yeah, I will say this. I mean, people do die. We're not going to create immortality. But with homeopathy, when people reach the end of their lives, they do that with a lot more clarity. Their life has they have a lot more perspective on their life. They know what their struggles have been about. This is what I mean by existential.
Yeah.
Another problem with the conventional world is that it profits so nicely from fear. You know, we don't know what your disease is. It's coming out of nowhere. Take all these tests. A couple of months, we'll get a result. Oh, well, the test is inconclusive. We need to do another test. And, you know, people live in fear a lot. The nice thing about homeopathy is it makes sense of things. If you have a chronic disease, chronic illness, and you come to someone like me, and I tell you we together figure out what its cause is, what it's rooted in your life history, that's great all of itself. But then on top of that, we give you the remedy that helps you to process that particular issue. You know, in other words, engage with a problem. You get a do-over. You get to revisit the scene of the crime under more favorable circumstances. And your psyche is able to deal with something that it simply couldn't deal with before because you were too young, because maybe you were beaten all the time, or something happened every single day, and your vital psyche said, "I give up. I can't handle this. I'll just accept it," which is really the basis for Stockholm syndrome, you know, identifying with the oppressor.
Yeah.
We make as our own the trauma that we have endured. So anyway, the way for homeopathy to deal with that is to give a remedy that prompts you to go back to that situation and win the battle that you lost previously.
What about things like dementia and Alzheimer's?
Oh, boy. Some stuff can be done from that, especially in the beginning. Those are hard to cure, but I've seen stabilization of those conditions where they progress much, you know, very, very slowly. You know, there are degrees of things. That's a difficult one. Also, the epidemic of autoimmune conditions these days. You know, this is infectious diseases. In the old days, homeopaths would routinely have cures of things.
Yeah.
But chronic things are things that are epigenetically, you know, ingrained. They can be. We have to have a different goal for those things. Stabilizing somebody, dealing with the issue at a root cause, so that it doesn't progress, so that you actually learn from your condition, and it doesn't. You know, that may be entirely sufficient, as opposed to leaving it alone and just seeing there's rapid deterioration in the person where they don't learn anything.
Yeah, I just I'm 80, and people around me are coming down with things like dementia and Alzheimer's, and, I'm looking at it wondering, you know, how best to, you can't avoid the inevitable, but how do you make the trip as pleasant as possible?
Absolutely. And by the way, homeopaths, you know, they dance to the times. Just in the last few years, you know, a few new books are coming out. We're constantly researching this. We're constantly refining, you know, expanding our knowledge and refining our abilities. So now we have a whole class of remedies that are proving to be extremely useful for dementia and Alzheimer's that we didn't really pay much attention to before, but we didn't know about. Also, knowing the kind of things in the environment that contribute to this, okay? First of all, I mean, we all have to know what those things are so we stop becoming addicted to plastic, stop becoming, you know, dumping antibiotics in everything. You know, they're obtaining causes. So how can you treat somebody if the obtaining cause remains? You know, if you have a headache, and I got the world's greatest remedy for a headache, but every 5 minutes someone smacks a book on your head, you know, your headache may not get better that much quickly. We have a lot of problems in society. We have there's a lot of pollution. Both atmospheric, there's EMF pollution. We have antibiotics, you know, all through our water supply, food. There's a lot of heavy metal toxicity. These are hard things to go up against. And to some extent, the body can adapt to it, you know, kind of get rebooted like the way we reboot a computer so that it manages to engage with it. But homeopathy is an awfully good resource.
It can make
the journey a lot easier.
It's a natural process to address with problems rather than drugs. I've found drugs never help anything. They mask it.
Well, but they're too strong. The side effects of a drug. The body says, I don't know. I can't handle this. I can't assimilate this. And the doctor says, well, in my opinion, the good outweighs the bad. When you take it again, take it again. But if you take a homeopathic remedy, it only works when it matches you. It doesn't work if it's not accurate. So the practitioner has to be accurate. But when it does, it's like a permission slip to the subconscious, and they allowing it to engage with this battle that it had given up on, its existential battle, re-engage with it, and emerge victorious. And the consequences of that are always good. But it's just energetic.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing material that's put in your body. It's like, imagine, Barbara, imagine, or think of anyone who's got a, you know, you just know them, they're troubled people, right? Imagine the best piece of news you could possibly hear. Everybody has that. If only this, if only that, right? But
yeah.
It's not going to be the same for you or for me or for someone else. Okay? Now, what happens if that piece of news comes true? Now, so for some people, it might be winning the lottery. For someone else, it might be their child getting into college. For someone else, their uncle, favorite uncle, recovering from a terrible disease. There's something that is the best piece of news that you can possibly imagine. Could you put that in a bottle? And
no.
who would benefit from it other than you yourself?
Yeah.
So that's another way to think about a homeopathic remedy. It's not exact, may not be the best piece of news there is, but it's a piece of information that your vital force is craving to know. And it, again, represents an opportunity to reengage with a battle that has been lost and given up, and that you can now have a chance to win because you're returning to the scene of the crime under more favorable circumstances.
Years ago, my doctor and I got into an argument, and he finally just threw his PDR at me and said, look it up. If you'll take it, I'll give it to you. If you won't, forget it. And I would look at the side effects and say, you got to be kidding. No, I won't take that. And of course, I did not die. So It's
good
kind of like, well, among other things, I have vertigo, and the medication he wanted to give me caused vertigo and personality disorders and all sorts of stuff. I said, I'm in enough trouble now. No, I don't think so. We'll just learn to deal with this and get on with life. And that's what we did. I noticed that you have combined acupuncture, Chinese acupuncture, with your, with the company that you put together. What does acupuncture do above and beyond what homeopathy does?
Yeah, that's my section in the book on the inborn emotional toolkit. And I can go through that with you. Chinese psychology is not very complicated. There's five core emotions. Joy or happiness is one. Anxiety or worry is another one. Sadness is the third. Fear and then anger. Those are five core emotions. Not particularly complicated. So what I did, I made a little model using I used that to create a model to explain a couple of remedies in homeopathy. So this is the idea of my inborn emotional toolkit. It likens those emotions to tools. Why is that? Because tools are something that you use and then you put them away when you don't use them. In other words, when someone says, oh, I never want to be angry, that's a mistake. Anger has a purpose. The purpose of anger, it's a tool to repudiate an affront. Somebody does something to you, you should take out your anger tool, you know, and use it to get rid of them. And then you put it away when you're done. So you don't want to never be angry, and you don't also want to be always angry. You know, that's the overuse of that tool, which I liken to a hammer, the hammer of anger. Now, there are people who have been, like especially women, who have been brought up to be seen and not heard, to be polite, to never express their anger, to suppress their anger. And what's happening there, the metaphor is very useful. they're using the wrong end of the hammer. They're using the claw end to dig away at themselves and, you know, blame themselves for anything that goes wrong, and they just cannot use the other end of the hammer. And the good things about people like that, I mean, they have a strong sense of pride, a strong sense of honor, but they develop stomach problems, they develop skin problems, they develop urinary tract infections, and they displace their anger. They what they suffer from is what I would call the dysfunctional cousin of anger, which is vexation. You know, make their hands into a claw, and they just gripe, and they'll go into their room and they'll cry, or they'll slam a door or a cabinet, they'll throw something. The thing there is that kind of anger does not solve a problem. It is not cathartic. The tool that you use, genuinely healthy anger, should solve the problem. If someone is attacking you or insulting you, it should get rid of that problem. Afterwards, you feel better. If I'm testing the remedy regarding that has to do with that using the wrong end of the hammer, the question I ask is this: how do you feel after you've been angry? Do you feel better or worse? And the person with a dysfunctional form of anger says, I always feel worse after I'm angry. I feel guilty and sad and so forth. That's not healthy. So that's the underuse or the incorrect use of the hammer of anger. You know?
Yeah.
Let's take – you go through each of the versions of this. There's the sketch pad of happiness, okay? It's a sketch pad. We are happy when we know – when we have purpose in life, when we have things we want to do. And you imagine put them on your sketch pad, your goals. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You know, that's what my purpose is about. It's a very healthy thing to have. But if that's the only thing you do, if all you do is dream about what you want to do, you never put anything to action, you know, you're overusing your sketch pad. After you have your ideas there, then you've got to turn out and do something with them.
Uh-huh.
So homeopathy, the remedy for people whose minds are overactive but have a hard time actualizing themselves, they might need a remedy like sulfur. And that's a natural state for children. They're curious and they look at things. You don't expect a child to be an architect. It's a natural state. But there are people their minds are not consolidated. They just think too much, but they don't really do anything with it. And they're prone to stomach problems and skin problems and quite a few things. Now, how about somebody who underuses the sketch pad? That would be a perfect picture of depression. Somebody who thinks that there's no purpose in life, that they're so disappointed they can't do anything, they don't know where they are. It's like their sketch pad is crumpled up and grimy in their pocket or their pocketbook, and they might need a remedy like sepia. And I have to go into depth and explain that. But sepia is a remedy, often comes up for women, again, who are deeply disappointed and resentful. But they're naturally optimistic, and they're constantly feeling like the undertow of disappointment. Anyway, that's the use of the idea of the sketch pad of happiness that in Chinese medicine relates to the element fire, by the way. That's why that comes from Chinese medicine, within the five element theory. And the purpose of the sketch pad of happiness is to conjure goals in life. As I say, it's a tool. And once you conjure those goals, put your tool away and go to work. Make your goals actual. The second tool is the screwdriver of anxiety. Okay? People say, I never want to be anxious. They feel like anxiety is a terrible state. Well, you should be anxious in order to determine if a goal that you have is viable. You know, there's always going to be risk in something new you're going to try or something that challenges you. If you're going to bite off more than you can chew, you know, if you're going to go out on stage, are you going to perform well? I mean, it would be appropriate for your to be anxious at that moment to make sure that you're engaged enough that you have a good performance. People who worry about everything apart, you know, every single thing in their life becomes something that they have to worry about. They might need a remedy I talked about before, like arsenicum. They're such perfectionists, and they feel like they have so little time that they're overusing the screwdriver of anxiety, which involves a bearing down on something. You know, the way when you screw something, you have to bear down on it. Well, after you've done that, then you put your screwdriver away. And there are remedies for people who are heedless, the remedy I've talked about is one that's called ammonia carbonicum, where people are deeply bitter and they're just so disappointed and pissed off that they become heedless. It's like they don't give a damn about anything. It's like they don't even bother with the screwdriver of anxiety. So that's the second tool, right? Is this making sense to you so far?
Third tool.
Okay, let me do the third one. These are obvious, but this is Chinese psychology is not complicated. So the hacksaw of sadness. I liken sadness. The tool that you need in regard to that is a hacksaw, because at some point, if you've had a loss, you have to make a clean cut and move on. If you grieve the loss of your grandfather for 25 years, that's a problem. You're either overusing if you're crying all the time, you're overusing your hacksaw, sawing away and sawing away, but never cutting through. And if you're someone who lost somebody important but never cries, and that's a remedy called natrum muriaticum, then you not use your hacksaw of sadness. You won't make the cut. Their psyche thinks, oh my God, are you kidding me? If I get over this loss, that would dishonor it. This is a really big loss, so I'm going to carry this around with me all the time. If I cry, I'll cry forever. So I can't have that. So the purpose of the hacksaw of sadness is to liberate us from attachment. And overusing it was a problem one hand, and not using it all is another problem. And both sides of that equation have remedies that would be used to produce an appropriate use of that emotional tool. Here's one, the fourth one, the pliers of fear, okay? Ordinary language is very useful because we say we're gripped by fear, right? I'm gripped by fear.
Yeah.
So an idiom like that is very useful. So I use the idea of the pliers. Well, what's the purpose of the pliers? It's to use them. You take them out if you're in a certain situation of danger, and you've got to figure out if you want to fight or run away. So you should be gripped by fear just long enough to make that decision. And I talk about remedies, I'm not going to do it here, in which people are just so fearful all the time that it's like they can't let go of their pliers. They're constantly gripped by fear. And there are other remedies where they're reckless. They just have no fear at all. They just that's another problem. They get themselves into dangerous situations because they just have no sense of fear. And the fifth one I talked about before, which is the hammer of anger. And there are people who are angry, just look at them wrong. People who come out of, war veterans who've been exposed to trauma, PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just look at them wrong and they think, what are you looking at? And they want to create a violent situation. They're terrified. They have been so traumatized by violence that they're in a completely adrenalized state, and they respond to every situation as if it's life-threatening. And then the other one, the other underuse is the one I talked about before, which is a remedy called staphylos sagria, where people are using the wrong end of the hammer. They're clawing away at themselves, and they simply uh-huh. cannot solve a problem, which is to repudiate and affront. So that's the basic idea of the inborn emotional toolkit. We all have those five basic emotions. We have that basic toolkit. Each of those tools are something that should, in a healthy state, be taken out and used to solve a problem. No one emotion is good by itself. No one emotion is bad. They're tools that should be used to balance ourselves in life. And what I found is using this Chinese medical model that I can diagram certain remedies that exactly express the overuse or the underuse of those tools.
That's amazing. Do you ever use reflexology to determine whether something is appropriate or not?
I don't find I need it. I know that's a good thing, but I find that my questions and my observations are sufficient. That's at least my skill. I don't need that. But my clients will sometimes use it to test themselves to see if I'm on my game.
Well,
so they'll use a dousing instrument or something. Yeah.
Oh,
they can do that.
Pendulum. So how does someone, I mean, obviously this is something that is very specific, there's a great deal of specificity to it. So how does one find a homeopathist who is credible? I mean, every food store has, every health food store has someone there that is their homeopathic whatever, but how do you find someone who is gifted enough to be able to diagnose?
No, it's a profession. There are certifications. There are two major certifications. Very easy. You look for the credential, the acronym CCH, There's the Council of Homeopathic Certification, or CHC or CCH. So people who have that credential, that's the gold standard. They have been trained. They've been doing this for years. They've taken a test. They've submitted their cases. They've gone to a school. The CCH, Council for Certification of Homeopathy. People can Google that and look for see if someone, a homeopath with that credential, is operating in their neighborhood. And the silver standard of this is NASH, NASH. That's the North American Society of Homeopaths. That's almost as good a credential. It's just not quite as strict. But people who have that credential, they've also submitted cases. They've studied. They're committed to practicing it. People get confused. There are a lot of people who try to use that word, and there's a lot of confusion. Two other words start with H, holistic and herbs. So I can tell you, people will come to me and say they've been to a homeopath, and it turns out they've just been given herbs. Or they've been to, they think that homeopathy means anything gentle. That's not true. It means the law of similars and the law of similars only. Homeopathy is indeed holistic, but there are a lot of things which are holistic which are not homeopathic. If you want to find a homeopath, look for someone who has the credential of the CCH or the NASH, NASH. That's the end of the story. Actually, there are physicians there is a physician, AIHM, there are physicians who study homeopathy too. There used to be a lot more of them, but the physicians also certify themselves internally. But you want to find out if someone has actually studied it. It's not even taught properly in naturopathic schools anymore. If you go to a naturopath who says he or she is, they've got homeopathic remedies, but they make you take 15 other supplements at the same time. They're not classical homeopaths, and they don't really value the psyche and the vital force. It shouldn't be a remedy that's just thrown into the mix with a lot of other stuff. It's very minimal. If someone has done their job and listened to you and talked to you for an hour and a half and gotten a strong sense of you, a single remedy most of the time is absolutely enough to get you on the right path. You shouldn't have to take a whole, half dozen other supplements to reinforce the effect. So I'm glad you asked me that question, because people get it wrong all the time.
Is it once and done, or do you need to be reevaluated
Let me answer this. I mean, these things are never easy. I'm treating a child. A child is going to – basically what the remedy does for the child is enable their normal development. Because whether you do something to a child or not, that child is going to develop in very dramatic ways from month to month, year to year. Adults, it depends on how sick they are. If they have a long-standing problem, you see the homeopath basically every 5 weeks. In my case, in my practice, people who are quite sick, seeing them – every 4 or 5 weeks, really straightens them out, gets them going. A single remedy doesn't usually turn you into a perfect person, but it really peels one layer away at a time, and you definitely feel the effects. Elder people, it can be used in hospice situations. It can apply in many, many situations. Most people have become familiar with homeopathy through its power as an acute form. If you've been stung by a bee and you take Apis 30, within minutes, you'll start overcoming the effect of the bee sting. If you've been plagued by a tick bite, Lidum, there's quite a few remedies that are used. You don't have to go through this extensive analysis of one's emotional state. It's just known as a low potency remedy that it can help you. As you said, arnica. Almost anybody can benefit from arnica without knowing hardly anything about homeopathy. Arnica should be on the on the sidelines of every football game, and maybe in the bucketfuls, because on every single football play, someone is being injured. And I'm not in favor of football for that reason. Flag football, maybe a whole lot more. But all these sporting events, you should have arnica nearby. I also do, advocate people understanding what that is. It's not it does not suppress your symptoms. It's not a conventional drug. It's a homeopathic, which means that the arnica, is a very dilute version of that plant, and it's acting on your emotion, on your spiritual body. People should learn that, but the arnica is on the same shelf in the supermarkets or Whole Foods, they still have it there as herbs, you know, and that creates confusion.
Oh, definitely. But I would not be without arnica or aloe. Both of those.
Are you talking about homeopathic aloe or herbal aloe?
Talking about a plant that I cut and I squeeze.
See, that's not homeopathic. That's good. That's herbal medicine. But aloe is also a homeopathic remedy.
Ah.
You know, the dilute version of that is something different. So, I mean, this is what I mean. People don't know the difference. They've not been told that there's a difference between something that has a material presence and something which is pure energy. There's a big difference. Arnica
wow.
has nothing material in it. If you took the arnica remedy to a lab, all they would find is sugar. They would not find, because it has been diluted so many times. It's not the same thing as an herb. I know the both words start with H, but that's not my problem.
I'll have to go back and reassess what I've got in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I mean, I know aloe. It's a great plant. Yes, you can make a strip of it and put it on a wound. But the principle of its action is herbal, which is very good, but it's not the same as the homeopathic.
Well, what would the difference be between the aloe from the plant itself and what you call aloe?
Okay, I'll tell you what aloe is. Aloe as a homeopathic would be used for diarrhea.
Really?
Yeah, it has a different purpose. So, in other words, if you actually consumed a lot of aloe, the actual aloe would actually cause diarrhea. So the dilute version of it would treat that.
And what I use it for usually are burns.
As an herb, it's completely different. Aloe Socotrina is the homeopathic remedy.
Cool. I have to go back to school, clearly.
Well, I mean, just keep the things distinct. Homeopathy is the law of similars. You have to be rigorous about that. It's something the remedies are very, very dilute. They don't have a material presence. I mean, I have to say this over and over again. And the confusion has been created deliberately by the medical forces, the pharmaceutical forces that benefit from your being confused on this matter. They don't want you to understand homeopathy. They don't. It shouldn't be such a revelation. I mean, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, people understood this. It was, you know, everybody kind of knew what the law of similars was. These days, people have been encouraged not to believe in it and not to understand it.
Well, with everything that's coming out these days, with the with people taking greater responsibility for looking into things, I am totally hopeful that they will read your book and gain a great deal of insight from it and seek out a homeopathist in their neighborhood to sort of address. Did I make up a word? I think I probably did.
No, that's okay. You can say homeopathist. But anyway, yeah, if your people buy Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress, it's put out by Inner Traditions, but you'll find it on the Internet. Simon & Schuster distributes it. You'll learn a whole lot, and you'll learn...
Oh, my goodness, yes. The one thing I have to put out there is, please don't anyone try to follow his recipes. Because, you know, the amount of whatever goes into it determines a lot of what it causes or cures. I mean, you name the things that go into the treatment, but you don't give, you know, how much of this and how much of that.
Well, it is, anyone can benefit from understanding it. But it's true, it is, practitioners, it's probably more practical for practitioners who actually, you know, whose knowledge it enhances. But you're reading the book. You see that you get a lot out of it. You start to get an understanding of how the mind and the body are connected. And people will relate to the existential questions that are at the core of our existence. You know, how do we act? Are we in synchrony with ourselves and with others? Is my presence in the world sustainable? Am I oriented in time and space? Can the life boundary between life and death be abided? Will the insurrection of my birth prove fruitful? These are very, very deep questions. We don't ask them consciously all the time, but at the subconscious level, they are being asked. And when the answer is not satisfactory, guess what? We get sick.
Yeah, well, I think
people
that,
just knowing that just generally should be liberating for people, even if they can't apply the exact treatment. They're not practitioners.
Well, I think also the other part that to me makes a greater sense is that today getting in to see a doctor is impossible. And if you're lucky, you'll get a prescription that probably won't do anything for what you've got. And I would imagine that someone who's practicing homeopathy takes the time to spend an hour and a half with someone and really understand where their what their issues are and where it's coming from. And I'm not saying don't go to a doctor. I'm saying have an alternative, you know, in your pocket as well.
That's absolutely right. Medical diagnoses can be useful. But, yeah, homeopaths, a good practitioner will make you feel that you're getting a concierge treatment. You're getting a very, very special form of attention. And by the time you leave a homeopath's office, you should say to yourself, wow, that guy, that woman knows me better than anybody I have ever met in my life.
Well, not only that, but, you know, taking the time to listen. And quite often, I don't think, you know, if it's a nurse's aide just an assistant, you're not talking to somebody that has the medical understanding, but the medical understanding doesn't necessarily treat the core issues, and that's what homeopathy does, and that's what I like about it.
Yeah, that's right. But by the way, some of us do have strong medical backgrounds. As I say, this is practiced by a number of physicians also, conventional physicians. It can be done. It can be, if you take the time to study it, you get a very deep level of understanding of medicine as well. My expertise is in Chinese medicine as well as homeopathy. But there are, as I say, physicians, veterinarians who have their own credentialing for homeopathy. And so these are substantial educational backgrounds involved.
Okay, so I have a question. It may be a bit off the track, but not totally. Does this apply also, possibly, to pets?
Yes, absolutely. There's an entire Richard Pitcairn is a veterinary homeopath. Has a whole association of veterinary homeopaths. There are lots of books on veterinary homeopathy. it's established. It's well known. There are veterinarians who are exclusively homeopathic. Yes.
Makes a great deal of sense. Well, we have run over by just a little bit, but you want to give your website and where people can get a hold of you if they need to?
Sure. I've written 5 other books besides this one. If you go to rightwhalepress.com, you know the whale, the right whale, RIGHTWHALE, rightwhalepress.com.
Uh-huh.
You'll find my publishing website. If you go to Substack, you'll see my newsletters. I've been writing a lot of late, Jerry Cancer Substack. But the emotional roots of chronic illness, if you Google my name, Jerry Cancer, and then the emotional roots, you'll probably find that book comes up at the Simon & Schuster site. Just know the title, The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress. Or if you put my name in and say homeopathy books, all my stuff will probably come up that way too.
Comes up on Amazon too.
Yeah, I mean these books are, these are published by, wrote up by Simon & Schuster, and they're on Amazon. Yeah.
The previous
book I wrote is more of a history book, very, very interesting, about the history of homeopathic mental hospitals in this country, which has been suppressed. That book is called Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind.
I love it.
Yeah. People could take a look at that. That's an intriguing book.
It sounds fascinating. I'm going to have to look for that one. I thank you so very much, and this has been so informative. I'm going to have to check out that other book, too. So thank you so much for being a good sport and coming back and trying again. I don't know what happened the first time, but this has been fascinating.
Oh, my pleasure, Barbara. My pleasure. You're an excellent interviewer. I appreciate it very, very much. Thank you for introducing me to your audience.
Oh, well, I'm sure you're going to hear from some of them for sure. So I'll get this up on YouTube and I'll spread it around and hopefully you'll have some calls.
Yeah, let me know and I'll post it on my media.
Okay, I will get that out to you as well. Thanks again.
Okie doke.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, everybody, check this out. Do take a look at it. It makes so much sense. And again, I'm not saying walk away from traditional medicine, but I am saying take this into consideration and understand the wisdom behind it and the sense it makes. It's definitely something you should have an understanding of, wisdom of, and if need be, a good practitioner as well. Take care, everybody. Good night.